Welcome to the Arlington Street Church podcast. Founded in 1729, Arlington Street continues today as a gathering place for progressive people of faith in the greater Boston area and beyond. We are located at the corner of Arlington and Boylston Streets, across from the Public Garden in Boston, Massachusetts. Please visit ascboston.org for more information about this historic Unitarian Universalist congregation. Arlington Street Church, gathered in love and service for justice and peace.
Our reading this morning is a poem by Marge Piercy called The Visible and the In. Some people move through your life like the perfume of peonies, heavy and sensual and lingering. Some people move through your life like the sweet, musky scent of cosmos, so delicate, if you sniff twice, it's gone. Some people occupy your life like moving men who cart off couches, pianos, and break dishes. Some people touch you so lightly, you can't tell what happened. Others leave you flat with footprints on your chest. Some are like those fall warblers you can't tell from each other, even though you searched your Petersons. Some come down hard on you like a striking falcon, and the scars remain, and you are forever wary of the sky. We are all waiting rooms at bus stations where hundreds have passed through unnoticed, and others have almost burned us down. And others have left us clean and new, and others have just moved in. Here ends the reading. I'll begin the sermon with the words of Muhammad Ali. Friendship is the hardest thing in the world to explain. It's not something you learn in school, but if you haven't learned the meaning of friendship, you really haven't learned anything. One of the least talked about and most important facets of our lives is friendship, and it seems we often get further from its power and potential simplicity as we get older. The Irish poet Padraig O'Tuama shares a story of a small boy at a conference where Padraig was leading a children's program. He asked the group of young ones to do a version of the prayer that Ignatius of Loyola taught, to imagine themselves walking somewhere lovely where they felt happy, and then to imagine Jesus walking by their side. They could ask questions, Jesus might ask them questions. They were meant to simply have a chat in their imaginations. And then they could choose, after the meditation was done, whether they wanted to share or keep it to themselves. Padraig had asked the children first where they went on their walks and had taken answers from a few of the children before moving on to the next question. But he was interrupted by a small boy with some urgency, and he guessed the boy was about 4 years old. He says, "You didn't ask me where I went for my walk," said the boy. "True, I didn't," Padraig said. "Where did you go for your walk?" "Sam's house," he said, like it was completely obvious. And Padraig writes, "I loved him instantly." Padraig goes on to explain, he knew that we all knew that everybody needs a Sam's house. I didn't know this small fella's name, never mind his city or even his nationality. I didn't know who the heck Sam was or whether Sam existed in his imagination or in reality. There was a particular quality to his language, his simplicity, his pure assumption that we would all know who Sam was. It was cute, sure, but it was also true. "The next day I went looking for the small boy," writes Padraig, "the boy who liked to go to Sam's house. I found him eating peanut butter on toast with his parents. I nodded to his parents and sat down, but it was the small one I had business with. 'Who is Sam?' I asked. 'My friend,' he said, chewed for a while. Then he looked at me and he added, 'It's very good because he is four too, like me. And he is my neighbor, and he's my friend. And I can walk to his house by my own self, but I have to be very careful. Of all things most beautiful, friendship must be the most beautiful of the beautiful. Nobody taught him. It was something he discovered in the space between himself and Sam. They each found a hole in a fence and wandered through. There they became something and someone they had not yet been before. Friends. All real living is meeting, wrote Jewish philosopher Martin Buber. And in his famous work, I and Thou, he goes on to explain that the way we become truly human is by encountering others and being able to see them on their own terms, and in turn to be seen fully as who we are. Not seeing who we wish they were or who they wish we were. Not reducing each other to a thing or a function, but meeting in a place that he called the narrow bridge between two souls, a vantage point that can allow each to be their own person, wholly, and find recognition of the sacred spark in each of them. This, Buber wrote, is the source of meaning and humanity. His contemporary, Rainer Maria Rilke, in his letters to a young poet, writes, "For one human being to love another, that is perhaps the most difficult of all our tasks, the work for which all other work is but preparation." And he goes on to define love, saying that it consists in this: two solitudes that protect and border and salute one another. Mystics in every tradition describe a state of union with another, sometimes the divine, sometimes another human being, sometimes the divine in another human being, as the purest state of being. And while that can take the form of physical encounter, the most exalted ways of describing it are a full awareness of the holy presence that moves through all beings. In Gaelic, this is known as the anamkara, the soul friend, someone with whom you completely belong because you are fully seen and known. Now, all of those exalted notions of friendship set a very high bar for that true living that is meeting, though, and don't tend to delve into the complications of getting to that stage of knowing and being known with someone, especially when we're well past the age of four and wandering through a hole in a fence carries more risks than it once did. We're living in a time in history when we can have hundreds or even thousands of friends or connections on social media, and we are also finding ourselves in the midst of what the Surgeon General has called a loneliness epidemic. Loneliness is considered to be one of the biggest underlying causes of what are now called diseases of despair, drug overdose, suicide, and alcoholic liver disease, which claim tens of thousands of deaths in the US each year. The statistics of the numbers of people who can claim that they have six or more close friends have nosedived in the last decade. One in five single men say they do not have any close friends, while only 59% of Americans say that they would have what they describe as a best friend. This is even worse for young people, 9 out of 10 of whom suffered from loneliness to some degree, and nearly half of whom reported that they have difficulty making friends. It's sobering to think about. Olivia Lang, in her book, The Lonely City, points out that loneliness is not the same thing as being alone. It's a feeling of lack of emotional closeness and connection, and everyone has different levels of contact they feel comfortable with, which is why some folks are content with a lot of solitude, and others feel lonely even when they are in a romantic relationship or have a seemingly vast circle of friends. Lang writes, "The cure for loneliness, in short, is intimacy. And the problem with intimacy is that it's frightening." One of the things Lang found in her research that is definitely true to my experience is that loneliness alters your perception. It magnifies the sense of social threat. And what this means is that you tend to notice and remember difficult or awkward social encounters far more than those that run smoothly. Instances of perceived rudeness or rejection loom really large, making the lonely person more withdrawn, less willing to reach out. It doubles down on itself, loneliness does. The poet Philip Lopate captures one angle of this altered perception comically and also a little painfully in his poem, "We Who Are Your Closest Friends." "We who are your closest friends feel the time has come to tell you that every Thursday we have been meeting as a group to devise ways to keep you in perpetual uncertainty, frustration, discontent, and torture, by neither loving you as much as you want nor cutting you adrift. Your analyst is in on it, plus your boyfriend and your ex-husband, and we have pledged to disappoint you as long as you need us. In announcing our association, we realize we have placed in your hands a possible antidote against uncertainty, indeed against ourselves. But since our Thursday nights have brought us to a community of purpose rare in itself, with you as the natural center, we feel hopeful you will continue to make unreasonable demands for affection, if not as a consequence of your disastrous personality, then for the good of the collective." We've all had that fear, right? True friendship, the kind that leads to that exalted sense of love in Rilke's framing, of two solitudes that protect and border and salute one another, requires risk and vulnerability and disappointment and even heartbreak. Yet we often behave as if there's a binary. We simply connect with people or we don't. And certainly we don't, can't connect with everyone we meet in the same way. But too often we behave as if friendship is something that should happen without effort, intention, or risk. And so that first sign of disappointment or a sense that we let ourselves let someone else down, we withdraw, preempting direct conflict, but also blocking the deepening of relationship, getting in our own way. Many of you might have already seen the documentary Will and Harper, which came out just this past fall. In it, we get this beautiful insight into the levels of friendship and the courage it takes to deepen into one another's truths. Will Ferrell, a well-known comedian and actor, and Harper Steele, a comedy writer and showrunner, had been friends for nearly 30 years when Harper began her transition. Having been known as a fairly cis-presenting man before, and now living as the woman she always knew herself to be, Harper reached out to friends with great fear and trepidation to let them know. To explore the new landscape of their friendship, Will and Harper go on a cross-country road trip in which Harper bravely brings her new self into the places she used to travel unnoticed as a man. And one of the first questions Will asks on the journey is, "Have the rules changed?" Suddenly, the friendship demands another kind of attention. Am I getting to know a new person or more about the person I already knew? In their conversations, we hear sadness that Will holds over never knowing something so elemental about a friend he considered close. And we hear Harper's journey of self-acceptance. Harper's committed to drinking the same cheap beer she has always loved, still enjoys dive bars and taking a break from driving by unfolding a camping chair in a Walmart parking lot. And we see also Will's willingness to companion Harper in through all of this, and also his lack of understanding of the privilege of his goofiness and his celebrity, in contrast to the profound internalized shame Harper is working to heal. Will is protective of the new vulnerability he sees in his friend. And none of the film would be possible, nor would their deepened friendship be true, without Harper's willingness to risk sharing her journey with no guarantee of acceptance. If you haven't seen it, I recommend. The idealized notions of friendship and romantic relationships of love don't tell us the other side of the story. No one arrives in our lives knowing how to love us exactly as we want to be loved, in part because we ourselves are on a journey to learn who we are, what we have to give, and why any of it matters. The poet David White writes that in the course of the years, a close friendship will always reveal the shadow in the other as much as ourselves. And to remain friends, we must know the other and their difficulties and even their sins and encourage the best in them, not through critique, but through addressing the better part of them, the leading creative edge of their incarnation, thus subtly discouraging what makes them smaller, less generous, less of themselves. In his novel, Howard's End, E.M. Forster writes, "Only connect. That was the whole of her sermon. Only connect the prose and the passion, and both will be exalted, and human love will be seen at its height. Live in fragments no longer." My friends, this is the whole of my sermon today, an invitation to live in fragments no longer, to take the heartbreak and the loss of love as a gift of understanding its depth and power, to continue to take the risk, like the little boy in Padraig's workshop, to pass through the fence. Each time we get to know another's essence on their terms, we're participating in the magnification of a sacred essence in the world. Seeing one another whole, we have the power to save each other, to build a world not out of fantasy, but out of the glorious and messy reality of our existence, and to bring forward a spirit of grace and abundance that is sorely needed in this world. Though we may be afraid, let us connect. Though we may be discouraged, let us connect. Though we may be disappointed, let us connect. Because love is all we have. And in the end, it is all we can truly give. Amen. David White says, "Courage is what love looks like when tested by the simple everyday necessities of being alive." May we go forth to connect, to love in the midst of everyday necessity, knowing our lives depend on it. May love hold us all until we meet again. The service begins when the service ends. Amen.
please visit ascboston.org for more information about this historic Unitarian Universalist congregation. Arlington Street Church, gathered in love and service for justice and peace.